Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. An essential part of the road to full equality for women has been the opening of careers in the broad range of disciplines, careers that were previously forbidden to women, and perhaps no person has had as much effect on the opening of the sciences to women as that person known as Madame Curie. We get a deep encounter with Madame Curie in Davis Sobel's newly released book, The Elements of Madame Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science, in which Deva traces the life, science, and missions of Maria Saloma Sklodowska-Curie from her youth in Poland through her entrance into scientific research in Paris and to the eventual fruits of her life, including two daughters and two Nobel Prizes, one in physics and the other in chemistry. Marie Curie's efforts opened the way into science for scores of women during her lifetime and for innumerable women over the following century plus. Deva Sobel captures both the scientific exploration and the human side of Madame Curie, alongside her humanitarian and peace efforts. As always, for Spirit in Action, we seek to uplift the stories of world-healing workers, and that would include the work of both Deva Sobel and Madame Curie. Remember to support our support of world healers by donating on northernspiritradio.org. Especially important right now to give us enough funds to make it to our year-end major fundraiser. Right now, we don't have enough even to get through this month, which is why I'm highlighting this need. But the important thing right now is Deva's work, which includes books like The Glass Universe, Galileo's Daughter, and A More Perfect Heaven. Deva Sobel joins us via Zoom from Long Island in New York. Deva, what a delight to have you here today for Spirit in Action.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be with you.
And you're out there on Long Island, and I'm here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Have you traveled the world a lot?
I have, and I've been to Wisconsin a few times, and I'm headed there next week for the book festival.
Are you going to duck over to Eau Claire, Wisconsin to visit? Well, you have the Dragon Room back here. You're always welcome.
Well, that wasn't on the itinerary, but I'll see what I can do.
I just finished reading The Elements of Marie Curie, just finished yesterday. How long did it take you to write this book?
About 4 years.
And that's research during COVID?
Yes. So COVID really changed my plans because, of course, I was going to go to Paris and work in the National Library and the Curie Museum. And then no one was going anywhere. But fortunately, because Madame Curie is Madame Curie, virtually everything she touched has been digitized. Her lab notebooks, all her papers, all the volumes of the weekly reports of the French Academy of Sciences going back centuries. You can read them all online. Even very personal things, the journal of her grief that she kept for the year after her husband died, all of that is accessible.
I thought I read in the book that there was discussion of destroying some, or is that Irene's, some writings that they had considered destroying so that people wouldn't get the personal glimpses. Because her diary and such was very personal, the letter.
Not to be destroyed, no. That it was not available to people. The very personal documents were not made available to scholars or researchers until around 1990. Waiting a certain amount of time after her death, which is common.
When did Eve die?
She was born in 1904. She died in 2006.
So she was still alive.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought maybe you wait until your descendants are passed and then could free up the personal things.
I think individuals can make those stipulations, but I don't think she did. I'm not sure she was thinking about that.
Well, I finished reading the book. It was rich for me in part because, in addition to doing my radio programs the last 19 years, I was a computer science physics major and I was a math major. And during my Peace Corps experience in Togo, I was teaching physics, chemistry, and math. And when I got back, I taught some classes at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee as well in physics. So for me, there's a lot of overlap with my background in studies. Your studies were not all science, but you seem to have a very good grasp on it. Did you have to amp up your science intelligence a lot to be able to write this book?
Yes, I had to approach the science as it was known at that time. For example, you know, today, if you try to explain the difference between atomic weight and atomic number, well, the number is the number of protons in the nucleus, and the weight is the number of protons plus the number of neutrons. But what did atomic weight mean in Madame Curie's day, when no one knew the atom had a nucleus, let alone that there were things called protons and neutrons inside it? So this whole history unfolded over the course of her life, and I wanted to be able to chart that, to really talk about the science she did as she perceived it and as understanding grew over her lifetime. So it was very challenging. I often, in a project like this, can find a tutor to work with. And partly because of the pandemic, I think, and the nature of the subject, met lots of chemists who were happy to talk to me, but didn't know the history and couldn't get at it this way. So it was extremely difficult. There's a lot of science in this book, and I'm proud of all of it because it took a lot of doing.
You've written a number of books that deal with aspects, I'd say, of science. Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, Letters to Father, The Glass Universe, The Planets, The Suns Stood Still.
They're all about science, yeah.
They're all about science. So I'm wondering if it's science that captivates you or specifically women that captivate you. I mean, I know you're the nexus of those two, but what got you in that direction?
Definitely science. So my mother worked as a chemist. My father was the local doctor. We had his office in our home, so his patients and all their problems were part of daily life. Everybody talked about science. I have two older brothers, but nobody told me that because I was a girl, I wasn't supposed to be interested. Very fortunately for me, I got to go to the Bronx High School of Science, which was a fantastic experience. In fact, I thanked three of my high school teachers in the credits for this book because my high school French and high school chemistry were so good that they really helped me. And I'm very late in coming to the issue of women in science. And that happened only with my previous book, The Glass Universe. Yes, Galileo's Daughter is about a woman, but it's really about Galileo and his science. His daughter was not a scientist. I got into that story because of what their relationship said about Galileo that was counter to the popular understanding of who he was and what he stood for. But my interest in women in science came about in realizing that writing about the women of the Harvard Observatory, I was constantly feeling surprised by what they had done, surprised by their ability. And I had to admit that I had come to them with embarrassingly low expectations, that despite all the advantages I had enjoyed, I had somehow absorbed a negative attitude about women that was just in the air in the 1950s when I was growing up.
And it certainly was in the air very heavily at the time that Marie Curie was living too. I mean,
yes, it was. But her family didn't behave that way. So her father, her older brother were her champions. They felt she deserved an education and whatever it took, if she had to be a governess and move to Paris, great. She should go do it. They were all very strongly behind her, which I think is part of her strength and part of the reason she was able to accomplish so much. I think family support is crucial.
Unfortunately, you've had that in your household.
I have.
Not everyone gets that, and that limits them significantly.
Definitely.
Let's start out by having you correctly pronounce her name growing up, because I don't speak Polish.
So her name was Maria Salomeja Sklodowska, and she was called Mania at home.
Which is Polish equivalent of Marie or Mary?
Maria. Mary, yeah.
And so she starts out from Poland. As I was reading about her family, I mean, there was the fact that Russia had dominated, had erased Poland to a significant degree. And it was, she's forbidden to speak her local language. She's forbidden to learn a lot of things that, because she's a woman and because she's Polish both. I mean, I think that kept her from that. But I had the impression still that her family, and certainly the family attitudes, were at least middle class. They weren't just lower working class.
Oh, no. In fact, above middle class. Kind of old, failed nobility.
Right.
So her parents were both teachers and the heads of teaching academies.
And the way that they did with her and that she did then with her daughters, teaching them at home becomes a vital part of the household, which I don't know how many people understand or don't understand that that makes such a drastic difference. I didn't really have it from my family. My family is well enough educated, but definitely working class. I didn't get that at home, but somehow I had a thirst for it anyhow. So she grows up being encouraged and empowered, like you can go anywhere, do anything. Yes, we'll support you. We'll be behind you. I have a feeling that that's the big subtext behind Marie Curie.
I think it has tremendous significance. I wish everyone had that kind of family support. And the letters between her and her siblings survive. And you can see how close, how loving the relationship is. And her letters with her daughters have been collected. I had two volumes of letters to rely on, and those gave me so much of a sense of what it was like to grow up with a mother like that, how interested she was in everything they did. And yet she was called away. She was very busy with her own work. She often missed their birthdays, but she didn't forget.
When I was in fifth and sixth grade, there was a bookcase in our library, which was all biographies. So I read Jim Bridger, Mountain Man. I read Florence Nightingale. I read a whole range of them. I don't remember reading a book about Madame Curie. There were some books out there, and she certainly has been a subject of interest for many, many people. But somehow I think I missed it. So thank you for catching me up on what I should have read back when I was 11 years old.
Well, you can appreciate it more now, I'm sure.
Certainly the technical part of it, Ken. So you said that this is, I guess, maybe your second book concentrated on this nexus of women and science. Mm-hmm. Why this book? Why is this one important to you? For Spirit in Action, I'm trying to lift up people bringing light to the world. And I guess she's bringing light in terms of radium and of knowledge as well.
I think she brought several kinds of light because she lived through some terrible times. The times we're living in are very difficult, but she lived through the First World War and saw a mission for herself because she had knowledge of X-rays and realized this was the first battle in history where it was going to be possible to examine wounded soldiers and actually see inside their bodies to where bullets had lodged. Before that, surgeons would just dig blindly for bullets. So she outfitted her own mobile X-ray van and drove it to the front lines and faced a fair amount of resistance from military authorities, as you might imagine, and even from the doctors who were not familiar with X-rays and didn't realize the boon that they provided. So she was demonstrating that in numerous places. And then recognizing the breadth of the need, she started a school during the war for French women who would be willing to take a 6-week crash course that she designed to teach them about X-rays, electricity, and human anatomy. And then she could take them or send them to these outposts so there would be X-ray facilities in many places.
And that's not by any means the first set of adversity that she lived through. As I mentioned, Poland basically didn't exist at that time because Russia had taken over, and that Her family and Polish people were second-class citizens at best in that setup.
Exactly. And she felt that terrible downplaying of her culture, not at home, but certainly in the schools, in any public space. That's why when she got to Paris, it seemed so open to her, because the people spoke their own language and they could air their opinions in public and nothing terrible happened to them.
But I do think growing up under that kind of subjection to foreign power starts one saying, okay, how do I reach toward the light? How do I increase the good in the world?
And originally she wanted to go back to Poland as a fully educated professor and improve conditions there by educating the people. That was her mission. But then she met Pierre and fell in love and stayed in Paris and pursued her science, but also continued teaching. So she was teaching women who were going to be instructors at female academies. And for a while, she ran a little co-op school for her daughter and the children of her colleagues, because she thought that the traditional schools gave too much homework and not enough time for exercise. So you can imagine a school where about a dozen kids learned physics from Madame Curie and chemistry from a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, and a real artist took them to the Louvre and talked to them about art. And it must have been the most extraordinary teaching situation that ever was. And it lasted about 2 years.
I'm wrestling with my view of what she was like, what Pierre was like. Clearly, she lived out a life even after she was involved with someone else. She was so devoted to Pierre and his idea. It's like, no, put his name on it, not mine. I don't know if this is simply that she's humble or she didn't want the burdens of the limelight, which she faced a number of times in her life. At the beginning, I thought maybe theirs was a marriage of science. We both love science, and therefore we will be together, and that'll work well because we've got science binding us together. I had that impression, but then following up on how much she continued to love him and be thankful to him afterwards, I had the feeling that maybe she did fall head over heels in love with him.
Absolutely. And the way she talked about him in the biography she wrote about him, that he was a person who seemed to be on a higher moral plane, that he had none of the greed, the wish for self-aggrandizement, none of, she called them littlenesses that we recognize in ourselves and in other people. And he just seemed to be above it all. And she wanted to emulate him. And then when he died, she wanted to keep his memory alive and remind those who knew him of the reasons why they had loved him.
There were just many ways in which I have a feeling that perhaps our society still thinks that even though our society has improved so much in terms of how it treats men and women from what it used to be, the limits that were forced upon women have been largely removed, not completely. We still, I think, have in our culture the sense that a woman's supposed to be feminine, whatever that means to you. And I don't think she cared a lot about that. That's just my impression. But who am I to say? The pictures of her, she looks comely. She looks attractive. And so
she was very attractive.
I just don't.
I think she just didn't think about it. She was very busy. She had her eye on the important things. She just didn't seem to trouble herself about it. Her younger daughter, who was quite beautiful and also very fashionable from an early age, talked about how Marie just looked at her mystified when she would put on makeup and wear high heels. And for Marie, all of that was very foreign.
And yet Marie was able to be supportive of her music. And yeah, I'm supporting you where you're going, which is, of course, what we'd want, not just say, follow in my footsteps only. And she did that well. I did have the impression a number of times that because of her devotion to her work and because her husband was gone after the accident with the horse, that she did not turn herself as much to the care of her daughters as I guess I would have expected of any parent, the sole single parent left, I guess. Was that your impression, or am I reading something into this?
No, it isn't. I know that her grief was tremendous, and she didn't talk about it with them. She kept her grief in the private notebook, but her concern for them never flagged. And she had Pierre's father, who lived with them and helped raise the girls, so that they definitely had a nuclear family with a female role model and a male role model. They didn't have any sense that she neglected them or failed them.
She does stand out in history as of particular importance. I mentioned, of course, Florence Nightingale. We know about her. We know Cleopatra. We know some names going back. But this is, in terms of science, one of the very first that becomes very prominent.
One of the very first, and unfortunately considered the only. You know, she's so famous. Everyone knows her name. If you ask people to name three women scientists, they'll say Marie Curie right away, and then they stop.
You know Maria Mitchell?
I do, but do most people?
I only know because she's Quaker. But
right? Didn't she pronounce it Mariah?
Well, I never talked to her, so well would I know.
I think, of course, I didn't either, but I have visited her homestead, and that's how they talk about her at the museum, is Mariah.
Now, I grew up Catholic, but because I've been involved with Quakers for basically all of my adult life, I learned that Quakers, they blazed the path towards equality for women far before many of the cultural groups in the United States, this innate belief in equality. So, you know, Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, all these people who are influential. And the other thing was that because Quakers tried not to engage in the frivolities of life, a lot of them became business people or scientists.
Well, Maria Mitchell was trained by her father.
Right, of course.
Observations. And then she was the librarian on Nantucket.
So there are cultural things that can allow every individual to thrive to their maximum. And there's attitudes that try and hold people back. Whether it's slavery in the United States, keeping people from Africa limited from accessing a lot of their great strengths. There's any number of cultural artifices we use to hold people back. Marie somehow transcended those. Part of it, it's her family. Part of it's moving to France. And I think she just had that fire burning in her.
She did. And I think that's another reason she stays in the popular imagination. For example, one of the things that surprised me when I was working on this book was the number of people who would say, oh, she's my heroine. And a lot of these were not people who were interested in science, but they just see something good and determined about her. The actor Alan Alda, who wrote a play about her, he's quoted in an interview as saying that she is his heroine because she never gave up, that she is a perfect model of not giving up. And so when he thinks about her sometimes, she carries him through difficult things because she didn't shy away from things that were difficult. She certainly took on a lot of difficult things, including world peace.
Yes, including world peace.
Yes, having survived World War I, having seen the number of casualties and deaths that she saw close up, it was really important to her to do whatever she could to keep that from ever happening again. And so she was part of this international committee, was part of the League of Nations. Albert Einstein was also a member of the committee. And one of the things she tried to do was to make science in all countries accessible to all scientists, to have some kind of central bibliography about work that was going on everywhere. And perhaps it's not surprising, pretty much what we have now with the internet, that we can access anything. But that certainly wasn't in existence then. She didn't get the cooperation she needed from editors in different countries. People get very accustomed to doing things their way and not wanting to change.
And some of the limitations, though, were also the bureaucracy that wanted to keep stuff for themselves. It's not just here's publishing techniques. It's more like the government doesn't want you to share that with those other people. Why would the German government, even though you're connecting with all these wonderful German scientists, the German government doesn't really want you to give their advantage away to other countries.
Yeah, science is an interesting mix of cooperation and competition, even leaving the government out of it. But just among scientists, the way everything builds on everything else. One of the women who came to work for Madame Curie, Ellen Gleditsch, wrote that she learned how a problem comes up in one laboratory, and then people work on it in another laboratory. And then maybe in a third laboratory, the solution comes to light. And that's how progress in science is made. So people are cooperating and sharing information, but at the same time, they're very competitive. They want to be first. They want to be the ones to win the prizes and the grant money. So it's a constant mix.
And folks, the voice you just heard is that of Davis Sobel. She's over there in New York. Her website is davissobel.com, davasobel.com. If you don't remember those letters, just come via northernspiritradio.org. I'll have a link to her, and I have links to all my guests from the past 19 years. I've been doing both Song of the Soul and Spirit in Action. We have her here to talk about her latest book, The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. And that's just one of at least seven books I see that she's written. Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, The Planets, The Glass Universe, Letters to Father, and The Sun Stood Still. A lot for me to get reading on.
There's also A More Perfect Heaven. I noticed that's not on your list. You'd think that would appeal to you.
It might, yeah. Send me the book and we'll talk about that in a future interview.
Okay.
You'll find a link to Deva and to her newest book, again, The Elements of Marie Curie, on my website, along with all those the past 19 years. If you come to my site, you'll be able to find the 35 or so community radio stations across the U.S. that carry our programs. We love your input, so please comment. I don't know how much you get to benefit from this, Deva. I hope you do. But when I speak, when I share valuable people from around the world, I love feedback. I love hearing what communicated, what didn't. That's how I can craft and improve what I'm doing for the world. So please, if you do visit my website, post a comment and let us know what you're thinking. Make suggestions. Help lead us to more light as you can. Also, I'd love it if you donate right now. We don't have payroll money for this month. We've run short. We do our fundraising at the end of the year. And so please do support Northern Spirit Radio and support those community radio stations who are such valuable alternative sources. I think in having dealt with the limitations that Marie Curie was subjugated to in her early researches, the shack she had to work in and all that, because the funding wasn't there. Please support those community radio stations who are bringing elements of thought and music to your community, stuff that's locally grown. So please support them if you're able. Now, back to Deva Sobel and the elements of Marie Curie. Let's say just a couple things again about the name. I keep stumbling about which name. You told me the correct pronunciation of her name. She didn't use her Polish last name because women give up their last name.
She did keep it when she wrote papers. Sometimes she was Madame Sklodowska-Curie. But sometimes she signed herself Madame Pierre Curie, not even using her own first name. So she was of several minds about that.
And considering that her longevity in the scientific domain, her time with Pierre was really the first 10, 15 years of her scientific life. But you had another 30, 40 years after that where she's a significant voice in that. And yet she's using Pierre pretty often. It's a peculiar way that we have in this world. Actually, my wife and I, when we got married, we made up a new last name. We said, who are we together, instead of taking my father's, her father's. And an independent-minded person like Marie Curie, I thought, might have stepped in that that direction more than she did. But her enduring esteem for Pierre was very impressive. You relate in the book, Deva, about the number of times where, well, okay, they can recognize Pierre for this. They can give this award to him, but not to her. Fortunately, she's recognized for 2 Nobel Prizes, 1 in physics, 1 in chemistry, which is, she's one of only, I think, 6 people who've had 2 Nobel Prizes.
And she's the only one who won in both physics and chemistry. The other 2-time winners were both in physics or both in chemistry. Linus Pauling won 1 in chemistry and then won the Peace Prize. Nobody other than Madame Curie has won both physics and chemistry.
You spoke of her effort to bring scientists together to share, to have that kind of sharing be a bridge of nations for peace. And she was a big supporter after World War I of the League of Nations. She definitely got focused in this direction. Do you have any idea where her peace orientation came from? I mean, there are a lot of people
from
who served.
From her first-hand experience of war.
But there were millions and millions of other people who did that, didn't become peace people.
You're right.
And I mean, she went in as a healer, which I think makes a difference. I think Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, that they obviously are trying to heal and therefore they get more invested in peace. But what led Marie in that direction? Do you have some? I'm not sure I know yet why, what led her. Her scientific knowledge didn't necessarily make her a peace person.
Well, it made her a person, and her family made her a person interested in, as you say, spreading light, lifting others. That was always a concern of hers.
She didn't seem to reflect a lot of bitterness about the way women were treated, subjugated, limited. Not that she necessarily didn't have it, but I just don't think that those are the words that came out of her mouth a lot.
No, they weren't. She was more focused on what she could do.
But her actions definitely show her efforts to transcend that. The number of women that she made sure she empowered, particularly in her laboratories, was really impressive. I can't go through all the names. You mentioned Ellen Gleditsch. She was from Scandinavia. She had them from so many different countries, from England.
Harriet Brooks from Canada. Ed May, Sybil Leslie from England. She had Branca Edme Torres from Portugal. They came from all over. It was a real melting pot in the lab. And the men, too. We're talking about the women, and I focus on the women in the book. But her Radium Institute included men from China, Japan, and India.
Which were looked down upon by many people in Europe at those days.
Not by her.
Yeah, she was able to transcend that with her knowledge. Let's talk a little bit about the steps in science, because she really walked through a frontier. I mean, fortunately, there's people like Rutherford and others around that time. The periodic tables being put together, there's a whole number of pieces of scientific knowledge that are coming together. As a scientific-leaning person myself, I was amazed to think of how many steps you have to go through to get to what I learned in the 1970s when I was in the university. And it's quite amazing to not start out with the ideas of electrons and protons and neutrons and how that varies what you're thinking about. Avogadro's number exists by the time she comes along, but still to have any idea of how an atom is constructed, she did some amazing steps forward. And that takes a kind of intelligence that so few people have. She was rich in it.
She was. She worked hard. And she studied. And she did experiments. She had developed her taste for experimentation fairly young, because fortunately she had a cousin who was a curator of a museum in Warsaw. And he would let her into the museum at night when it was closed to use the laboratory there. Really, in her schooling, until she was in Paris, she didn't have anything but the books she picked up to read.
We can take for granted radioactivity these days, but the phrase didn't exist back then. And to even have that concept as opposed to, well, something happened or it gets warmer or it shines. That's quite a leap. And that kind of intelligence, again, is rare enough in this world. There's so many ways in which her researches around radioactivity have been based to much of the modern science that we know these days. And she overlaps with Einstein and with the whole discovery of quantum physics.
She's in on all those meetings.
I found it very interesting, the group that you described in the books, where they get together. It's basically all these high-level scientists get together and talk.
Right. Invitation only.
Only the best, most fruitful minds. Let's put them together.
And she was at every one of them.
And somehow she got included in that.
Well, somehow, because she was at that level.
But it was still a time when so many people made the prejudice against women, limiting from them. What's the academy that she wasn't allowed into?
The French Academy of Sciences.
Well, yeah, but you have to say it in French.
I'll let you say it in French.
Okay.
I can read. I'm fluent in reading, not in speaking.
Okay. Yeah, and that one is so amazing. Was it her daughter who was
her
admitted?
Daughter also couldn't get in and tried repeatedly. Her daughter, who also was a Nobel Prize winner, a highly respected scientist, could not get in. But it was one of the women Marie had hired as a lab technician who finally broke that barrier, Marguerite Perret.
It's just so amazing to watch how that worked throughout history. Again, we take it for granted. I came of age in the 1970s, and so I saw those changes happening with respect to women. It was, even though women were still very much a minority in sciences, I've been able to watch over the course of my life how that's changed. And it wouldn't have gotten there if it hadn't been for Madame Curie. She made such a difference. When the Nobel Prize was offered, and she got offered it along with Pierre, I guess because my main knowledge about it is from your book, Deva, I thought that she did more of the leadership in that than Pierre did, so that he was kind of like her helper in terms of these researches, as opposed to she being his helper, which is how the society wanted to classify her.
Well, they were very clear about who did what. They worked together. That's how they described it. So they shared the first Nobel Prize, but she received the chemistry prize herself after Pierre's death. So society definitely recognized her. They didn't want her to go to the award ceremony because of the scandal surrounding her love affair with a married man. But she reminded them that libelous attacks on her private life had no bearing on the merit of her scientific research. And she went to Stockholm and accepted the prize.
This all starts with radiation, or what came to be known as radiation. And I was trying to picture how that exactly came about. Uranium is known by the time she comes on the scene. I'm not sure in all its isotopes, but...
No, isotopes were still an unknown phenomenon. So they knew about uranium, but the fact that uranium emitted some kind of radiation was a very new discovery. And that's what she decided to focus on for her dissertation research. Then she discovered that the same kind of radiation came from the element thorium. And then she started testing other elements to see what else there might be. And she tried a kind of uranium ore that was far more active than uranium itself. And she figured there's got to be another element in there, something no one knows about, that's responsible for this extra emission. And that's what set her on a course of finding that mystery material. And there turned out to be two, polonium and radium, polonium being named for Poland.
Do you know, I'm not sure I got from the book this clearly, and again, folks, the book is The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. Do you know how they noticed its effects? I mean, radium glows, but a lot of radioactive materials don't glow, and they didn't have Geiger counters in their cloud chambers. What was the activity that they noticed?
So something that comes from it will leave an impression on a photographic plate. or it will make the air a conductor of electricity. And those were the tests that they had. That was really all they had at the beginning. With those simple rudimentary tools, she was able to judge the difference in radioactivity in different uranium compounds, between uranium and thorium, and then polonium, radium. And those emissions turned out to cause them injuries. Their fingers got burned. And so very quickly, doctors thought, well, if the material destroys tissue, maybe we can use it in cancer. That happened really fast. And for years, radium was the cure for cancer. So she lived through that, but then also lived long enough to see the downside and how dangerous the material was. And in fact, her own death is attributed to her long exposure to radioactive materials and to X-rays. I mean, during the war, all that time she was working with X-rays, she was wearing a cotton smock. You know, if you go to the dentist to get X-rays, they put a lead apron on you and the dentist walks out of the room. Well, she was right in the thick of it.
Actually, as I read about that in the book, the idea of using radioactivity to kill cancers, that is not the first thing that occurred to me. I think Pierre carried something in his vest coat. He carried it and had a burn underneath
it. And it was a burn, went right through the clothing.
When I read that, the idea that, well, oh yeah, it burns the skin, so therefore I'm going to try and use it to kill cancer. My goodness.
Well, they did. The doctors who heard about it immediately thought, and other skin lesions.
Right. That wasn't the first step my mind would have made. It's something that looks like it's lethal to tissue. Gee, I'm going to try and use it to fix tissue. It didn't occur to me. There was considerable excitement about these items that got to be known as radioactive materials, but I'm not quite sure just why. Yeah, a photographic plate will react to them, but...
Well, it was a new phenomenon of nature. It was something nobody had seen before. That gets the scientists all excited. What is it? Why is this happening?
I recalled when I was young that they still had radium dials on watches or something.
They did.
That still happened in the 1950s, 60s, 70s?
I'm afraid so.
It just kind of blows my mind considering the history with it. The women who were painting these dials and would put it in their mouth and their jaws fall apart. I mean, that happened enough decades ago.
It happened in the 1920s, yeah. But some of those watches were still around. I have a nephew who does watch repair as a hobby. And early on, he bought a Geiger counter, because he really didn't want to mess with the ones that actually had radium in them.
She lived through so much, and considering that her initial research, hers and Pierre's initial research, really took place in a shack.
Yeah, they had a little shed that had been an anatomy theater for medical students. And I love the fact that it had a glass roof that leaked, because, of course, we use the term glass ceiling now as an invisible barrier to women's advancement. But she was working under an actual glass ceiling.
Well, let's try and sum up overall the achievements of her life. Number one that stands out for so many of us is she enabled women to go beyond where those glass ceilings were in so many ways.
I'm not sure most people give her credit for that.
Well, I do.
Okay, good.
Mainly because Davis Sobel wrote The Elements.
Because you've read my book. Thank you. Thank you.
I do give her credit for that. That's certainly one of the fruits of her life. Her peace work, she definitely poured herself into it, including when her health was failing badly. She still said, okay, I guess I've got to go because that's what they need me to do. How do you rate the fruits of that part of her work?
Well, it's very hard to maintain peace, as I'm sure you know. Here we are with at least three wars going on right now. She died before the outbreak of World War II, but her daughter and son-in-law lived through that. No, I don't think anyone has been successful at attaining lasting peace, but I don't think we can blame her for that.
we can give some credit to Gandhi or to Martin Luther King or to Tolstoy even for his writings in that direction. So there's so many ways. And I wonder how much more her peace witness would have been empowered if she'd been a man working as hard as she did for that. Because there's so many people who are discounting her effects, her work, because she's only a woman. She's second place. But she clearly poured so much of herself into it. What about her fruits for the world in terms of science? I mean, she was part of this whole great exploration, finding about isotopes, finding that the transmutation of elements that happens in the course of radioactivity. She made a very big difference in science, but then she and so many other people who developed science, including Albert Einstein, kind of rued the day that they helped us to split the atom and lead to nuclear dangers for the world. How much credit should we be giving Madame Curie for that advancement in science?
I think she deserves all the credit she got. I think scientists always have to weigh what they discover with how it might be used when it gets into the wrong hands. I think just the number of schools and hospitals that are named for her gives some sense of how people see her as a force for good, as a positive influence, a guide, a teacher. She was all of those things. She still is.
And in terms of equality of women, you said that a lot of people won't recognize her so much for that. And yet she clearly did such wonderful strides at that time in terms of helping women receive equality, not only in science where she worked, but she's helping her daughters. She's helping the world recognize that.
Yeah, and the number of women who worked for her who later formed that International Federation of University Women, which was all about international exchange and scholarships for advanced study, all of that came out of the lab too.
Well, it seems that she's affected the world in so many ways. I want to take one more look at what Davis Sobel has influenced the world with your books. Again, I asked you at the beginning, was it science or was it the quality of women that led you to write this book? Overall, your works are raising up science?
Yes, I'm interested in science, and I'm sad that so many people feel they can't know about it or they don't want to know about it. I think understanding science has had a spiritual effect for me, because when you really learn about astronomy and where we as Earthlings fit in the grand universal scheme, we're so small, and yet we're connected to everything else. I find that a very comforting thought.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your religious or spiritual identity along the way in your life. I'm not assuming it's the same now as it was 10 years ago or it was 50 years ago. I'd love it if you'd share a little bit about how you think of yourself in terms of those both concrete and spiritual and religious, wherever they fit in your life. Could you lay out for our listeners for Spirit in Action some of how that progress has moved through your life?
Yes, so I was born into a Jewish family in New York. My parents were mildly observant. My grandparents were very observant. And as my brothers and I grew, we got even less observant. But we all, in our cultural, ethical identity, felt that we, or I still feel that I am a Jew, even though I don't go to synagogue. I have that connection. I have an annual Seder with my family at Passover that really brings all of us together from all over. We all cling to that time, to our memories of sharing that holiday with parents and grandparents, and now we're sharing it with children and grandchildren. So that is meaningful to me. But I'm open to other ways of thinking. And when I was writing Galileo's Daughter, which is about a nun who belonged to the Order of the Poor Clares, it was really important to understand things about Catholicism. At the beginning of that project, the idea of going into a convent to me sounded like voluntary life imprisonment. And I felt I couldn't really tell the story with that attitude. And fortunately, I found a modern day order of the Poor Clares and began a correspondence with the Mother Abbess there. She may be the happiest person I've ever known. So that really turned my ideas around. She was just what I needed. Then I got very interested in the history of Catholicism, especially the Order of the Poor Clares, who were the second order of Franciscans. And I remember going out to lunch with two of my friends and being so excited about everything I was learning and just talking to them about Francis and Claire. And one of them turned to the other and said, "I remember when she was Jewish." We all still laugh about that. But it really, you know, at its heart, you said you were raised Catholic, so you know this, but at its best core, Catholicism is about the greatest imaginable love. That spoke to me.
I've often said that I'm a good Quaker in part because I grew up when there was still the Latin Mass, my first 10 years of my life. When you participate in a religious observance where you don't know the language, you have to listen beyond the words. And that prepared me to be a Quaker in the way I am because I got trained that as a Catholic and it made my life richer.
Well, you're very rich and that's a wonderful thing. And I feel very rich too.
You definitely identified in the direction of humanism along the way. What does that mean to you?
Just being aware of other humans and their travail and the difficulties people face in life. You never know what someone is going through, anyone you might encounter in your day. And that makes me try to be understanding, to be kind, to give the other person the benefit of the doubt.
How does your view about that connect with your attitudes, your thirst, actually, for science?
I really find scientists very interesting. I'm sorry that they get such a bad rap, that people tend to think of them as automatons, really, without normal emotions. And it's just not true. So when I write these books, I'm very mindful of presenting the humanity of these people.
One of the very interesting things is the number of scientists, whether it's Niels Bohr or Einstein, or they become very peace committed as well. That science, some people think, well, if you're a scientist, you're only interested in the devices of science or your additional knowledge. You're not concerned about the world. But that is so far from the truth.
So far from the truth. And so many scientists have a very artistic side also. I've done so much interviewing of astronomers, and it's extraordinary how many of them are musicians. It's just almost comical. I just feel that that's part of my mission in life is to tell the non-scientists of the world that the scientists are real people too.
Really studly people, I think maybe is the word you were looking for, or not.
I don't know. I'm not often at a loss for words.
Well, Deva, it's been so enchanting to get to know Marie Curie through you. Again, folks, the book is The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. Deva Sobel's website is davasobel.com. The link is on northernspiritradio.org. Thanks for enlightening the world, both in terms of the science and the persons and the work for the betterment of the world that Marie Curie and so many other scientists have brought to the world. And thank you for your devotion to that work.
And thank you for what you do.
You can believe it's my pleasure.
I see that.
The links are on northernspiritradio.org. Please get a hold of this book and others of Deva's books, and we'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.